I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hey.
How are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
Yeah. You know, same. Fantastic.
Good.
Lovely. I'm excited for a story.
This yeah.
one's a little bit of a psychological one.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to delve in.
Good. I am too.
Do you have like a deal for us?
Oh, a deal? I mean,
like, I'm looking for a deal.
I always have a deal for
okay.
you at the
tell
top.
Tell me about the deal.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast, you can get access to almost 50 bonus episodes and all of our episodes ad-free and early. We put them out early for our lovely patrons, and we chat over there. We have a good time. It's a lot of fun. So, yeah, our patrons get to vote on the bonus episodes, so they're extra good. I mean, these episodes are also good. I put a lot of work into all of them, but you know what I'm saying.
You didn't vote on it.
You didn't get to vote on it. That's true. You just get to listen to the episode that I choose. So if you want to choose the episodes, then head over there.
Oh my God, such a good deal.
I think so.
I'm so excited.
Good.
And I didn't know about it before. So here we are.
Yeah, it's your first time hearing about it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you now know about
that. Wow. God, I'm an infomercial. And I'm an insufferable infomercial.
You
but,
are. And thank you for that. You also, know. I will continue to lightly tease that I'm working on something really exciting. And our patrons know about it. So if you want to know what I'm working on and what's going to be coming out soon, go over there because I literally told them. So if you want to join the super secret patron club, you too can know my secret.
Do it.
My secret will be dropping soon, but... You know, if you want to join the exclusive club for now, head over there.
Welcome, Squidward.
Welcome, Squidward. Welcome, Squidward. Welcome, Squidward.
Can we have that play like when people join?
I would love that.
Well, thank you for that. With that being said, what's going on this week?
The Stanford Prison Experiment.
Okay.
Yeah.
I peripherally know about this. I know some things.
Mm-hmm.
But I know... One thing that you did a deep dive on this, and I'm excited to see what else I don't know about it.
Yeah, this really started as one thing for me and ended up a completely other thing. So I really thought that I was just going to go into this learning about just the experiment and it was just going to end there. But turns out that like this experiment was not as ethical. I mean, we knew it wasn't ethical,
imagine
right?
That.
Like, we knew it wasn't ethical, but it was more of a lie than I anticipated.
Okay.
So
I love a good lie.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Wait, who's involved here?
We're going to get into
is
all of it.
Is it the government?
Well,
is it the government?
When isn't it the government?
I
we're
going
to get into all of it. So, why don't we just jump right in?
Let's do it.
Okay. Philip Zimbardo was born on March 23rd, 1933.
It's a great date.
Pretty good day, huh?
Pretty good day, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Personally.
Your birthday. Right.
Shout out the Aries crowd. Come on now.
Okay. In the South Bronx, he was born in the South Bronx in New York to a second-generation Sicilian-American immigrant family. In his early years, he suffered discrimination due to his Italian ancestry and was oftentimes mistaken for other races, which is what sparked his interest in psychology. He survived an early childhood illness and experienced a long stay at Willard Parker Hospital, a hospital for children with contagious diseases where he learned to read. His formal education began in New York Public School, 52, and he graduated from James Monroe High School. He was the first member of his family to pursue a college degree. In the early 1950s, he attended Brooklyn College and completed his BA with a triple major in psychology, sociology, and anthropology.
Dude, who does a triple major ever?
I mean, people do it.
They're... A double major is enough, but...
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. Double majoring is also kind of crazy, but triple, I mean, damn. Yeah, he did that. So the next year, he went on to earn his MS, and by 1959, he had also earned a PhD from Yale in psychology.
Okay.
So the man went to school.
Okay, Yale?
Mm-hmm. He briefly taught psychology at Yale, where he married Rose Abdelnour and had a son in 1962. He left Yale when he was offered a job as a professor at NYU, where he stayed until 1967. At the time, he began working at Columbia University, which was brief, because in 1968, he was offered a position at Stanford, and by 1971, he was a tenured professor of psychology.
No big deal.
Right. That same year, Zimbardo and Rose divorced. So, he's just a tenured professor of psychology at Stanford, on his own at this point. During the 1970s, both the U.S. Navy and the Marine Corps were interested in learning about the hierarchies of power in military prisons. The U.S. Office of Naval Research issued Philip Zimbardo a grant to study the relationships between prison guards and prisoners. The objective would be to determine if those relationships were shaped more by the prison environment or by the personalities of the guards. Was it the acquisition of power that made guards turn brutal, or was brutality actually intrinsic to human nature itself? The grant would be used to create a mock prison environment in which to conduct the experiment and to pay the participants. The experiment began with an ad Zimbardo placed in the classifieds of the Palo Alto Times. It read, quote, "Male college students needed for psychological study of prison life. $15 per day for 1 to 2 weeks. $15 a day wasn't bad for minimum wage type work. It had 3 meals, a roof, and a padded bed. And 70 people applied. They were interviewed, and Zimbardo had them take a psychological test. They were told it was an experiment on how individuals deal with captivity in a specific prison-like situation. There would be no threat of violence and no threat of sexual assault. Anyone who had a criminal record or record of abusing narcotics was eliminated, but pot was fine. Most of the participants were potheads who didn't give a shit further than getting a summer job, so they kind of had to be okay with them smoking pot at some point."
What year was this? This is in the 70s, right?
71.
I guess this is before the crackdown?
I think this was 71, but yeah, it was like the 70s.
Okay.
Ultimately, 24 college students, all white males, were selected to participate. Doug Corpy, who was selected as a prisoner, had an exam to study for, and he thought this would be a great time for him to be able to study for his exam because he would have all this time in a cell to study. He would bring his book, and this would be a perfect job for him to have time to just lay around and read his book. So they signed a contract stating they couldn't leave unless they had good cause, like something physical. And once they were selected, Zimbardo and his team randomly divided the students into two groups by flipping a coin, prisoners and guards. There were 12 in each category, 9 that were active participants and 3 alternates. This was the 70s, so they were all rebellious, young, drug-using, anti-war, long-haired kids. Every one of them could imagine being a prisoner, and at first, none of them could imagine being a guard. Many of the men who were selected to be prisoners were actually glad because they figured that would be a passive role, and most of the guards were actually pretty bummed they hadn't been chosen to be prisoners. But it was still $15 a day, so they were just happy to be there.
Seems like we got the selection a little wrong.
Right. Well, they didn't know how it was going to go. The men who were selected as prisoners were informed that they would not experience any physical abuse, but they would lose their civil liberties for 1 to 2 weeks. They weren't told much else about what to expect, only that they would be contacted on the phone to be at their residence on a given Sunday for the experiment to begin.
Also, that contract is not legal. You can't just take away your rights. It doesn't matter what contract you sign. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was a little nuts. The guards had a little bit more guidance before the experiment. They had a meeting on the day before the study officially began where they were issued real khaki-colored prison guard uniforms, nightsticks, mirrored sunglasses, which would prevent the prisoners from making eye contact with them, and they were introduced to Zimbardo, who would be acting as the superintendent, and David Jaffe, an undergraduate research assistant, who was playing the role of the warden in their fake prison. The two then instructed the guards and laid down the scope of their duties. First and foremost, the guards were told to maintain order. They were allowed to use any means necessary, short of physical violence. Things that were permitted included harassment, withholding of food, and the deprivation of privileges at the guards' discretion. They could use psychological torment and were basically encouraged to do so. During their orientation, the guards were told that their assigned task was to maintain law and order to allow the prison to function properly, don't let the prisoners escape, and control the prisoners in any way they had to. They were also told they would have to write a daily shift report on guard and prisoner activity, as well as critical incident reports on any out-of-the-ordinary events. They were told they'd be responsible for the administration of meals, work, and recreational activities of the prisoners. The guards believed that the experiment was solely to see how the prisoners would act. But actually, Zimbardo's team was equally interested in how the guards would treat the prisoners. So Zimbardo told the guards that they weren't even a part of the experiment.
This is an interesting play. I don't know. I would think that you wouldn't want to like lead them into any behavior.
Right.
Like, you're kind of leading them to, I don't know. It seems like you're leading them to be monsters.
Interesting you say that.
Mm-hmm. Because if you were like, just maintain law and order, and then they go wild, that's different than maintain law and order by any means necessary, including all of these things. So you're like suggesting what to do already. So what are they going to do?
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. I'm assuming that this is going to come up in an ethics review.
Yeah. So we're going to get into this more specifically later, but I'm glad you clocked that already.
Wow. Folks, I'm too good.
You're too good for this, huh?
I'm too good at this.
All right. So to help immerse the guards further on that day before the study, they assigned the construction of the prison. The study would be taking place in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department's Jordan Hall in a 35-foot-long area. It had little outside light and felt very cut off from the outside world. There were three cells that could fit three prisoners each. They were 9x6, which was quite cramped. Each prisoner had a cot with a pillow, a mattress, and a blanket, and that was it. If they needed to use the bathroom, they would be transported to and from by a guard, and they'd be blindfolded to disorient them further, and so they didn't see anything that didn't fit the vibe of the experiment. There was no daylight and no clock, which was designed to make the prisoners lose all sense of time. Each cell had an intercom wire set up so the experimenters could listen to conversations and make public announcements. There was a closet that they used as solitary confinement that measured 2x2x7. That area also had two fake walls, one for the entrance and another for a small observation area. The space between the walls and the cells was called the yard. The guards, unlike the prisoners, worked in shifts. The shifts, which only required three guards at a time, lasted 8 hours. They had plenty of space to move around on their downtime and opportunities for rest and relaxation. They got an area to change in and out of their uniforms after their shifts ended, and off-duty guards did not have to be at the prison, but they were asked to remain on call in case of an emergency. So the guards were treated very differently than the prisoners. August 17th, 1971 was the official day one of the experiment. It began when the nine prisoners were arrested by actual police officers from their homes by the Palo Alto Police Department. The men were taken outside, searched, handcuffed, read their rights, and put into the backs of police cars. Many of them were in full view of their neighbors as they were arrested or had curious onlookers who stopped to watch the unfolding drama. And the participants wanted to yell that they were just part of a social experiment because it looked very real, because they were actually being arrested. Each one was taken into custody, had their details taken down, they were fingerprinted, blindfolded, and moved into a holding cell. A lot of them were very shocked at the level of authenticity. And finally, the guys were blindfolded once again, put back into the car, and brought to the mock prison. Once they arrived, each prisoner was stripped naked, told to stand with their hands against the wall, sprayed with deodorant, which was supposed to simulate delousing spray, and made to stand naked in the yard for some time before given their prisoner uniform, which was a scratchy smock, or basically like a short nightgown, with their number on it. It went down to their mid-thigh, and they weren't allowed to wear underwear. They were given a nylon stocking to wear on their heads to simulate having their head shaven, and they put chains around their ankles. They had their mugshot taken, and they were given an identification number. Finally, the prisoners were brought to their cells and told to remain silent. From that point on, the men were only referred to by their numbers and could only refer to each other by their numbers. Everything they did was an effort to dehumanize the prisoners. They became an object in a system as opposed to an individual. And if they strayed from that, they were punished. And the way they were punished was basically up to the guard's discretion, quote unquote.
Cool. But like, do you need to do that to maintain law and order? Also, what law? What order? What do you mean? I don't know. A lot of questions here. Like, remind me of the original purpose of this. Like, what was the original why?
The original purpose was to investigate the psychological effects of perceived power and situational variables on human behavior. So they wanted to understand why guards and prisoners in real-world prisons acted in hostile and abusive ways, exploring whether these behaviors stemmed from personality traits or from the environment itself. So did their abusive behaviors come from bad people, or did the environment make the person bad?
I see. Well, I feel like you would need more than one study and certainly more than 9 people to determine that, right?
Yeah, and also the way you test it would need to be a little more controlled, no?
This is wild. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm like, I can't be, like, I'm not that smart, but I kind of understand like that you need a bigger sample size than this and you need to control for some of these variables, right?
You're definitely smarter than you're giving yourself credit for.
I'm like, I don't know. Like, we all did this 7th grade science project, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, you're not a psychologist per se, but you can see that this is bad science already. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, like, any result, I mean, sure, this is going to be interesting, but I just don't know if you'll be able to prove anything with this.
Sure.
Or even further the cause. Because, like, usually you need multiple independent studies to verify the same thing in different ways. It's something like that for it to be kind of quote unquote proven or more sure, rather than like, because, like, you could just get one study like this that shows something that's not true.
Yeah. I mean, the more studies you have, the more sure you can be about something for sure.
For sure.
For sure. But I think the main issue here is that he was not conducting the study in a way that, like, he was affecting the outcome. Like, he was manipulating the answer.
Right.
Already, you know? So from that point on, the men were only referred to by their number and could only refer to each other by their number. So everything they did was to dehumanize the prisoners, and they became an object in the system. There was a camera on the men at all times, but it wasn't always running. They had a fake wall with a hole cut out with a camera peeking through and audio recording devices. From inside their cells, prisoners couldn't see the entire hallway. They could only hear some noises. Once everyone had been brought into the fake prison, the warden went in to introduce himself and to read the men the rules of the prison, which had been created by the guards the day before. The prison rules and their ID numbers had to be memorized and would be asked 3 times a day during roll call, once for each guard's shift. At first, one of the guards, John Mark, said it was really uncomfortable, except wearing his sunglasses, because that helped to hide his red eyes, because he was high. So that was the only helpful part.
Oh my God, so you're high during the experiment?
Yes, because the guards got to leave, so he would just leave and smoke a joint and then come back, but he got to wear his mirrored sunglasses, so he didn't have to, like, show his bloodshot eyes. Yeah. But that first day was pretty awkward for him, trying to get into this role of guard when he's just this, like, hippie kid who, like, really wished he got to be a prisoner because he didn't want to be a guard. But one guard in particular took on a leadership role immediately, and that was Dave Eshelman. He immediately took to being a complete asshole. He would line them up outside their cells and run them through drills or scream in their faces. He would call the men names, have them do jumping jacks or push-ups or sit-ups, really just whatever he wanted to have them do.
So he was immediately on board.
Pretty much.
So he was an asshole.
Yes.
He was an asshole already. He had a pre-existing condition of being an asshole.
We're going to get into all of this later. So,
cool.
Because at first the prisoners thought this was all funny. They really weren't taking any of this seriously in the beginning, which only made Eshelman ramp up his assholeness. And because he was particularly assholey, the prisoners began calling him John Wayne, which was a little funny to Eshelman because John Wayne never played a bad guy, but they were all against the Vietnam War. And John Wayne at the time had recently come out in support of the Vietnam War, so they were basically calling him evil. Eshelman said at first he tried to make it entertaining, so he'd blow his whistle and make up drills as he went along. He'd have the men sing or tell the guy next to him that he loved him, really anything he thought that would humiliate the prisoners. He had the prisoners refer to him as Mr. Correctional Officer. He'd have them repeat things back to him. And that started out kind of funny for the prisoners. When the guards would have the prisoners chant something, they would make it silly in any way they could because they knew the guards couldn't hurt them. So they were just a bunch of college kids. And they're like, this really isn't that serious. So, like, whatever, we're just going to be silly with it. But then they started to selectively punish the instigators worse than the people who were, like, not as bad. The guards wanted the prisoners to show respect because, you know, that was their goal. So even though this was a fake prison, Eshelman began taking things pretty far, and some of the guards followed his lead. Eshelman had just finished his freshman year and had gone through hazing at his fraternity. His frat brothers had put his pledge class through a ton of different humiliations. They poured molasses all over his head and did things like make him rub burning ointment on his genitals. And some of his anger he felt for his quote-unquote brothers, meaning his frat brothers, was still in him. And now he was in a position where he could take some of that out on someone else. He had that power, and he said he knew how to use it. And at the same time, he was really into theater in high school. He was in every play, musical, and choir, and then he decided he wanted to become an actor. And his acting teacher told him to never break character, and he took that to heart. So this is a pretty dangerous combination.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like just the right guy to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
He was basically told, be the worst guard you can be. And he had just gotten tortured by his frat brothers the year before. And he was like, I am an actor. So he had a whole arsenal of, I don't even know what they did to him, but I'm sure he had a lot of stuff up his sleeve. And he didn't even really have to get very creative because Zimbardo gave him a lot.
Yeah.
Zimbardo made the guards believe they weren't being observed as part of the experiment. So he thought he was playing a part. Eshelman decided he'd become Strother Martin from Cool Hand Luke. Martin played the strict owner of a French language camp for children, and at some point during the experiment, he'd bang his nightstick against his hand and tell the prisoners things like, quote, I'm going to hit you so hard it's going to kill your whole family. He was described as creative in his evil, and he never broke character. So he was just like over the top with his guard character. Saying things like, I'm going to hit you so hard it's going to kill your whole family is like, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I would laugh, but
right.
I can feel the story going downhill.
Right, but
very quickly.
Exactly. Like in the beginning, it was funny to the prisoners and they were laughing. But then picture you're actually in a cell and you're wearing nothing but a tiny little nightgown down to your thigh and nothing else. And he's screaming in your face and making you do things. And he's in charge of giving you your food. And he actually is punishing you. So like after a while, it's not funny because these punishments are real.
Right. The withholding of food is like actually insane. Like,
well,
think that this is like, I mean, I have to wonder what the Geneva Conventions on POWs are, but I'm pretty sure withholding food is probably not allowed.
I don't actually know if he withheld their food or what, but I know he did things like take away their pillows and their beds and their blankets and like things like that, or he would throw them in solitary confinement. You know, it was things like that. And there was something that happened with their food later on that we're going to talk about. But yeah, it was things like that where my point is that like the punishments became real.
Right.
So even though it was over the top and like he was playing a part in his head, it didn't feel funny after a certain amount of time. It became not funny really quickly.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what the punishment is.
Right. But Eshelman rationalized his behavior by saying that they were trying to prove that prisons were an evil environment. That's what apparently Zimbardo told them that they were trying to prove. And since they were all anti-establishment students, they would have done anything to prove that prison systems were evil and that it was an evil institution. He was happy to play that role.
Yeah, wow. When you explain it like that, it makes so much more sense.
Right.
Wow. And to boot, like he has all that pent up rage on top of it.
Yeah.
He's like two birds, one stone.
Mm-hmm. Bad combination. And since Eshelman was top dog, Chuck Burton, who was another guard, fell quickly into the role of his sidekick. They made things up as they went along to make prisoners feel badly about themselves or just exhaust them physically. In a very short period of time, they were set on breaking the prisoners down. Going into day two, Doug Corpy had realized that not only was he not going to get his textbooks to study for his exam, but they weren't going to get any books at all. There was nothing for these prisoners to do. The guards kept doing irritating things to them, like not giving them utensils to eat and waking them up through the night to have them do count. He said, quote, they were making life yucky. But their job was to be a prisoner. And that was when Doug and the others realized that they got to act a little bad. They could really do anything. And Doug decided they could stage a rebellion. So on night one, he realized that the doors to the cells opened inward instead of outward. And because the guards kept waking the prisoners up, Doug got the idea to put their beds up against the door to keep the guards from coming in. Which was definitely a clear moment when the guards decided to ramp up their punishments. The morning guards were frustrated with the rebellion and called up the reserve guards who were at home and insisted that the night guards stay on. And now they had a clear reason to crush the rebellion and think of the other students as dangerous prisoners. The guards forced their way into the cells and took the prisoners' beds away, which eliminated their only sense of comfort. That was the only thing they had. But Doug didn't want the guards to win, so he ripped off his prisoner number, which was 8612, and threw it into the hallway, and yelled to the other prisoners to rip off their numbers as well. And many of the prisoners also refused to leave their cells, took off their stocking caps, didn't respond when they called their inmate numbers, and insulted the guards. They were all asserting their independence at this point still. And that was when the guards took their smocks. And underneath that, the prisoners had nothing. They were naked. So now they didn't have beds and they didn't have clothes. They were naked. They also chained the naked prisoners together, two at a time, one arm to one arm and leg to leg. So they were chained, arm to arm, leg to leg, completely naked.
Well, that escalated quickly. My God.
This is all within like 24
day?
Hours. Yeah.
This is the first day one.
I mean, this is like going into day two, but yes.
Whoa.
But Doug wasn't done. He had figured out that the locking mechanism for their cells was on the inside, and they had some plugs in their cell that had screws securing them to the wall. So they worked on unscrewing the plug until finally they got a screw loose. And when a guard would walk by, they would act like they weren't doing anything, until finally they used the screw to unlock the cell door and attempted to escape. Keep in mind, they're still chained together naked and with a nylon stocking on their head. But the guards very quickly figured out that two of the prisoners were attempting to make a break for it because their chains were quite noisy as they tried to hobble down the hallway, and they quickly threw them back in the cell.
Riddle me this. They're not supposed to physically harm them, but they can, like, throw them back in the cell? Like, yeah. What's the extent?
Like, they can't beat them with their nightstick, but they can throw them back in the cell.
Okay.
Their two rules are maintain law and order and keep them from escaping.
Well, there you go.
But, I mean, picture these scrawny college kids completely naked, chained together with stockings on their heads, breaking out of a cell and trying to break out of their fabricated prison in a hallway. Yeah, it's not great. This is day two.
And it's day two. How long is the study?
It was supposed to be 2 weeks.
Okay.
So once Doug got thrown back in the cell and he was still chained to another person, still naked, he realized this experiment wasn't fun anymore. His time there couldn't get any better, and it really could only get worse. And it did, because when Doug had his hands on the bars to complain about their treatment, one of the guards took a fire extinguisher and blew it at him to get him away. Doug had to get out of there, but he knew he had to be creative, so he said he had a stomach ache, thinking that would get him out. He was pulled out of his cell and was brought to the back to Zimbardo, who Doug found was extremely intimidating. He was a big guy. He was 6'1", 220 pounds, and was a fancy professor at Stanford. And Doug was 5'8", and 110 pounds. Zimbardo told Doug he couldn't leave. He was the leader of the rebellion, and he needed him to stay. They were making history, and they needed his input. Zimbardo offered him the option of potentially being an informant in exchange for the guards leaving him alone. And Doug left that room saying he'd think about it, but feeling like he couldn't really leave.
Okay, well, more leading of behavior.
Right. And also, Doug does not feel like he can leave at this point. When Doug was brought back out to the line of prisoners, he really didn't want to be there and told the guards to fuck off, which landed him in the hole. Which was not a good place to be, because it was a very small closet. As Doug lay in the dark on his side in the closet, he felt completely trapped and he became desperate to get out of there. He thought to himself, how the hell was he going to get out of there? It seemed like he couldn't just say he wanted to leave, they were just going to keep him. He had to do something big. He started yelling that he was burning up inside until he began screaming, I want out right now. And he completely broke down. At first, he was ignored, but he began hyperventilating and actually screaming at the top of his lungs. Dave Eshelman thought he was just a weak-willed person because this was nothing compared to what they would do during fraternity hazing, so they ignored him as he shrieked and cursed and cried. Even Zimbardo said, we had already come to think so much like prison authorities that we thought he was trying to con us. It took quite a while before we could be convinced that he was really suffering, and then we released him. Zimbardo said prisoner number 8612 had an emotional disturbance after only 36 hours and needed to be released. In 1992, in a documentary movie about the study, Quiet Rage, Corpy asserted that the prison experiment had deeply affected him and that the experience caused him to later become a prison psychologist. However, in a 2017 interview, he stated that his breakdown had been fake, and that he did it only so that he could leave and return to studying for his graduate record exam. So a lot closer to the actual study, he said that he had, like, a mental breakdown, and that it deeply affected him. In, like, 2017, he was like, it was all fake.
Well, I mean, I guess we won't know for sure, but no. It makes sense to me.
Either one is valid. Like...
Yeah, no, if I'm, like, chained to other naked men, I'm doing just about anything to get me out of there.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Five to Scream? Sure. Mm-hmm. I could do that for a long time.
Oh, yeah. In order to restrict further acts of disobedience, the guards separated and rewarded prisoners who had minor roles in the rebellion. The three spent time in the good cell, where they received clothing, beds, and food, which was denied to the rest of the jail population. After an estimated 12 hours, the three returned to their old cells that lacked beds. And they did this to break the solidarity of the prisoners. All the while, the guards continued humiliating the inmates and had the prisoners count off and do push-ups, restricted access to the bathrooms, forced them to relieve themselves in a bucket in their cells. Around that time, a rumor had started to spread that prisoner 8612, or Doug, had faked his mental breakdown and was planning on coming back to do a mass breakout. Zimbardo then decided to dismantle the jail immediately and called in all of the guards as reinforcement and had them put bags over all of the prisoners' heads and took them in an elevator to the fifth floor storage room to be hidden from any breakout attempt. And then the guards took apart the prison piece by piece as Zimbardo waited for prisoner 8162 to arrive so that he could inform him that the experiment was over and that everyone had been sent home. But Doug never showed. So that was just like a false alarm.
That's crazy. So you're trying to like hide the evidence of the study you're running.
Mm-hmm.
Insane.
Yep. And all of the other prisoners were in a storage closet with bags over their heads.
Are they all still naked?
I think they had their nightgown things on, but still, they had bags over their heads and were sitting in a closet for many hours while all of the guards were dismantling the entire prison.
Yeah, whoa, dude.
And then they had to put it back together. Crazy.
I guess.
And that made the guards mad at the prisoners, even though the prisoners hadn't done anything. So it made the guards more hostile toward the prisoners, which is unfair.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, they're pretty openly hostile.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. Zimbardo's team decided to place a new prisoner in the cell that 8612 had occupied, who was actually an informer. And once the prison was restarted, the guards continued to act sadistically to the prisoners, refusing access to toilets, forcing the men to do push-ups for hours on end, stripping them naked and forcing them into embarrassing positions, and screaming in their faces. The guards were also increasing the time it took to do count from 10 minutes to several hours. On day 4, witnessing the guards were dividing prisoners based on their good or rebellious behavior, the inmates started to distance themselves from one another. Rioters believed that the other prisoners were snitches and vice versa. Other prisoners considered the rebels as a threat to the status quo since they wanted to have their sleeping cots and clothes again. Zimbardo invited a Catholic priest to the prison to assess the situation, and he interviewed each of the prisoners individually. Half of the prisoners introduced themselves by their numbers rather than their name. The priest asked each of the men what they were doing to get out of here, and when confronted with confusion, the priest told them, quote, if they didn't help themselves, nobody else would. They were college students, they were bright enough to realize that they were in prison, and the only way to get out of prison was with a lawyer.
Wait, I'm confused. What is this priest doing? Like, is he part of the experiment, or is he like, you guys need to get out via a lawyer?
He was brought in by Zimbardo, so I don't know. Prisoner 819 was the only one who refused to speak to this priest, instead insisting for a doctor, and eventually he was convinced to come out and talk to the priest and Zimbardo, and 819 was brought to a side room, given food, and had his leg chains removed. And upon their removal, the prison guards made the prisoners chant, 819 is a bad prisoner. This sent 819 into a hysterical fit. He began crying. When Zimbardo told him it was time to leave the experiment, he replied, no, I can't leave. 819 didn't want to leave, but instead wanted to go back and prove that he wasn't a bad prisoner.
Whoa.
Yeah. Zimbardo was shocked by that and broke character and reassured him that this whole thing was an experiment. So he's like, you realize this is fake, right?
Still?
Yeah. I guess hearing the whole jail chant 819 is a bad prisoner sent him into something. And he was like, I have to go back.
Nah, dude, like, get out of there and go to McDonald's or something.
Nope. The guards had started using bags over the prisoners' heads as a routine form of punishment. After 819 left, he was replaced by prisoner 416. who was Clay Ramsey. He was stripped, deloused, chained, and put into the cell. But the other prisoners didn't feel a strong connection with him because he had been introduced in the middle of this experiment, and they had already been there for like 4 days at that point. So they had been through quite a bit, and he was now coming in fresh. So there was that. And also, he was just put into a cell, and they couldn't really see or hear anything when they were in their cells. So Clay only really made friends with one of the prisoners who was in his cell with him. By this point, the prisoners had become pretty subdued. They had already been subjected to trauma, and they weren't really in a mood to challenge the guards. They were exhausted. They were in a much different environment than the guards. The guards only had an 8-hour shift, and then they could go home, recharge, and come back. But the prisoners were there 24 hours a day. They had no idea what time it was or how long they had been there. They wanted the prisoners to feel like animals, and the guards were all in on that. Every day, they tried to top what they had done the day before. At least most of the guards were. The prisoners were barely allowed to sleep. They were woken up at 2 a.m. and then again at 4 and then again at 6. And not just woken up, but pulled out of their beds, made to stand in a line outside of their cells, and either humiliated, screamed at, or forced to do physical activity, the whole time being told how bad they were at it. The guards were trying to get a rise out of the prisoners so they could punish them more. If someone looked like they didn't like how someone else was being punished, they'd be pulled out of the line and be made to do the punishment themselves. Everyone was on their feet, barely awake, and they were being broken down in a very effective way. Clay Ramsey, prisoner 416, was shocked coming into this. It was a little too rough and angry for him. So since he was just coming in from the outside, he really didn't want to cooperate, which made him a target for the guards. They wanted to break him down even more. Clay said some people may feel like it was only 2 weeks, but he didn't look at anything in his life like that. He wasn't interested in wasting any bit of his life. So once he decided something was stupid, he wanted out of there. That was when he came up with the idea of a hunger strike. The meal that evening was hot dogs, and Clay decided he wasn't going to eat. The guards didn't know what to do at first. Unfortunately for Clay, the guard on duty that night was Dave Eshelman and Chuck Burton, which were the worst of the guards. They were enraged that he was challenging their authority. They told prisoner 416 that if he did not eat the 2 hot dogs, they'd shove them up his ass. And then they tried to physically shove the food down his throat, which didn't work. The only thing left to do was put Clay in the hole, which at first wasn't terrible for him because he had been quite sleep-deprived at that point, and he finally had privacy. The guards used this moment to turn the other prisoners against 416 and told the rest of them if 416 wasn't going to eat his dinner, they'd take everyone's blankets away. 416 had been in solitary confinement for 3 hours, even though the agreed maximum time was 1 hour. Unfortunately for 416, the head guard was Eshelman, and he gave the prisoners a choice. 416 could come out of solitary confinement in exchange for their blankets, or they could keep them and 416 would stay in solitary all night long. And the prisoners opted to keep their blankets. One of them said they would give up their blankets, which was his friend, but majority won. Later that night, 416 was still in the closet, and the guards ordered the prisoners to pound on the door and say, "Thank you, 416. His friend didn't want to do it, but he also didn't want to make waves at that point, and the guards also pounded on the door with their clubs and screamed at 416. The guards had been successful in breaking down the prisoners enough that they were turning on each other very quickly. The level of aggression in the guards was escalating, and the worst of it apparently happened at night when they thought Zimbardo wasn't watching. The guards put prisoners in sexually embarrassing situations, and we're going to get into this a little more later because there have been mixed accounts of this, but Eshelman said, quote, "If you make people objects by assigning them a number instead of referring to them by name, I don't see you as equal to me anymore, and therefore anything I do to you is justified," which is crazy. On the fifth day, they had scheduled visitations from friends and family in order to simulate the prison experience. But in order to reduce the risk of complaints from the outside world, the prisoners were cleaned, shaven, and fed, and the cells were cleaned. The families also had to take part in the experiment, so they had to register, were made to wait half an hour for no reason whatsoever, and were told only two visitors were allowed per prisoner. And their visitation time was cut to 10 minutes and was under guard surveillance. Before any family members were allowed to enter the visiting area, they had to discuss their son's case with the warden. And some visiting parents asked Zimbardo to contact a lawyer in order to get their son out of prison. They said a Catholic priest had called to tell them they should get a lawyer or public defender if they wanted to bail their son out.
What do you mean?
I don't know.
I want my son out now.
Yeah.
So it happens now.
I guess he had signed a contract and was getting paid for work, so like...
The priest?
No, the son.
Okay, well, I mean, clearly, like, you can't enforce that.
Yeah, I guess if they wanted to leave, they could have left, technically, but they felt like they couldn't, which is another ethical problem.
Right.
Yeah. That night, Phil Zimbardo's new girlfriend, Christina Maslach, came down to the fake prison to observe what they had been doing. She said seeing what the guards were doing to the prisoners, she immediately got sick to her stomach. Zimbardo was excited to show her, and Christina got very upset, teared up, and ran out of the room. Zimbardo ran after her, which was when she told him, "What you're doing to those boys is terrible. There was no reason for this, and he had to stop it now." Zimbardo said even he had fallen into acting like a prison warden instead of a researcher. On the sixth day, August 20th, 1971, the study was canceled, over a week earlier than it was intended. Even though the study ended early, the full amount was paid to each of the participants, which was $210, and that was approximately the equivalent of $1,700 in today's money. Finally, all participants were invited to return to the university a week later to share their opinions and emotions, and the experiment was over. Zimbardo concluded situational forces and social roles, rather than individual personalities, are primary drivers of human behavior, demonstrating that ordinary, quote-unquote, good people can quickly turn abusive when placed in a dehumanizing environment with unchecked power, such as prison guards. And shortly after the experiment was called off, it hit the news. Philip Zimbardo was all over the place, saying that evil behavior could be elicited in the best of people in specific scenarios. It was a very dramatic story. These seemingly normal college students became either sadistic assholes, complicit prisoners, or they had a mental breakdown in under 48 hours. Zimbardo claimed he had the answers to human nature. He became the authority on prisons and spent his career speaking as an expert witness in court cases, defending people in prisons who'd done awful things. The prison experiment ended up in psychology textbooks. Zimbardo wrote a book called The Lucifer Effect, understanding how good people turn evil, and he became wildly famous, and he built his career on this experiment.
That is insane.
Yeah.
The thing is he has the credentials to do this, but he clearly does not have the study to say any of the shit that he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's so insane. So a study that you didn't even complete with nine people? Also, even within the experiment, like, clearly there's more going on. Like, some guards were worse than others, right? Some followed the lead. Like, there was a lot of social dynamics that were happening that were more than just anyone can be corrupted given the right situation, which I do believe is true, but I don't know if that even this study proves.
Yeah. In his explosion of fame, Thibault Latexier, an associate researcher at the European Center for Sociology and Political Science in Paris, France, began taking a look at the experiment, and he noticed very large discrepancies between what Zimbardo said happened and what actually happened. After taking a look at everything, Latexier said, "All the experiment proves is that you can do very bad science and get away with it." But the official narrative was a lie. His interest into the experiment started as a side project. He used to make found footage films, and when he discovered the experiment, he decided to go to Stanford and go through the archives to learn as much as he could and build a film from all of that. He was very interested in this story of good and evil. Young students acting evil just because they were given power in a situation. He was very intrigued by this idea that there is a monster in all of us, or that men have evil inside of them. Zimbardo said over and over, if you take normal people and you put them in an evil environment, they become evil. But Dave Eshelman said, quote, I don't think you can draw conclusions from it because of the way it was done and the effect it had in tipping the scale, so to speak. It was good theater, but I don't think it qualifies as good science. And Letexier agrees. Letexier found the day before the experiment began was particularly important. After the experiment concluded, Zimbardo claimed everything the guards did was completely thought up by them. And he used the time before the experiment to give the guards very simple guidelines. They had to refrain from using any violence, and if the prisoners escaped, the experiment was over. But that was it. They weren't given any training, according to him. That's what he claimed in all of his interviews. But in reality, Zimbardo did have a training day for the guards before the experiment even began that was quite in-depth. And it was so in-depth that there was a participant that had been selected to be a guard who dropped out of the experiment. His name was Kent Cotter. He was originally chosen as a guard, and on day zero, which was their training day, Zimbardo had all the guards come to a meeting to explain what they were going to be doing. He told the men that they would have complete control. They could create boredom, a sense of frustration, a sense of fear. The prisoners would have no privacy at all. They would have total power, and the prisoners would have none. Zimbardo claimed that the guards made up their own rules, but in the archives, Letexier discovered a lot of evidence showing the guards were given the rules to enforce. They knew what punishments they could enforce, like putting chains on the prisoners, stripping them naked for a certain amount of time, handcuffing them, blindfolding them, cutting off correspondence between them, having them do push-ups or jumping jacks, planks or other physical tasks. He gave them a list of things just like that and even talked them through it. Kent Cotter immediately didn't trust Zimbardo and was suspicious of him. There was something about the way he conducted himself in the meeting that just seemed off. To Kent, it felt like the group was being pushed in a certain direction. He said it seemed like Zimbardo wanted something out of them, and they were there to do what he expected. First of all, they had gotten this list of potential punishments, which seemed weird, and most of the men in the group were really getting into the conversation. As things escalated among the group, Kent felt more and more isolated from everyone. They began talking about things they could do to the prisoners to make their lives worse, and Kent felt like he really didn't fit in, and he really didn't want to participate. Right after the meeting, he went into Zimbardo's office and told him he really didn't feel comfortable with what was being said. And at first, Zimbardo told him to stay and redirect it, but Kent said he didn't think it could be redirected. He felt like it was set up for the guards to be abusive toward the prisoners. Zimbardo wanted people to believe that the participants were spontaneously responding to the situation and fell into the role of guard seamlessly, when in reality, they had a whole meeting talking about the things they could do to make life worse for the prisoners, and Kent Cotter showed that even before the whole thing started, the participants could easily guess what Zimbardo wanted to prove. It was also a red flag for Letexier that Zimbardo also claimed the guards had made up their own rules, because in the archive, he found the guards had been given a suggested daily schedule and list of rules so they knew what punishments they could impose. In their own reports, they wrote, quote-unquote, schedule followed closely. So they were not reacting spontaneously to the situation at all. They were following a schedule given to them by Zimbardo. I'm almost certain all the guards didn't believe they were part of the experiment. They thought they were helping implement the experiment. A few of them said had they known they were the ones being studied, they would have acted completely differently. But even still, most of the guards weren't like Eshelman. There were one or two who followed what Eshelman was doing, but Zimbardo made it seem like every guard was just as bad as Eshelman, and made it seem like they were all sadistic assholes. When in reality, guards like John Mark hated being a guard. He had a lot of compassion for the prisoners. He was a big pot smoker. He studied Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Jewish mysticism, and Chinese art. And he had some really close encounters with getting arrested himself. So when he was a guard, he thought pretty much every day about giving all of the prisoners joints and how he wanted to be one himself. During the experiment, the warden pulled John aside and told him they noticed he wasn't acting tough. They thought he was letting the others take the lead and he was just acting neutral, which was true. And when John agreed with him, the warden told him he had to, quote unquote, kind of get it in you. John got a pep talk about how he should get active and involved with the other guards because, quote, the guards have to know that the other guards is going to be what we call a tough guard. So not only did they tell the guards exactly what to do before the experiment started, but in the middle of the experiment, they were pulling guards out and saying, you're not being tough enough. You need to be a tough guard. So they were absolutely interfering with the experiment and molding it to their expectations.
Right. This is insane.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how a tenured professor of psychology who's been teaching at Ivy League schools for years gets to this point.
Well, in a real scientific experiment, there wouldn't be any intervening to produce the results you want. They were just trying to make something jaw-dropping.
Right. I mean, in a true study, you'd have double blind, so you don't even know which group is which.
Sure. Yeah. Letexier said Zimbardo wasn't behaving as a scientist. He was behaving as someone who really wanted to shock the world. Zimbardo claimed he didn't intend for the study to become as big as it did in the media, and yet he had a TV station filming the quote-unquote arrests of the prisoners from day one of the study, and he jumped at every opportunity he had to make the story as sensational as possible. And over time, the story began to evolve to fit Zimbardo's narrative and growing fame. It wasn't until 15 years after the experiment that Zimbardo said Christina, his girlfriend at the time, was the reason it ended. He wanted this dramatic Hollywood ending, which ended in him marrying her a year later. The woman with fresh eyes saw the inhumanity and woke him up, which is what ended the study. One of the participants said, I wonder if he scripted that too. I don't know that that actually was scripted or that isn't the truth of why it ended, but it is interesting that that wasn't brought up as a part of the story until 15 years later.
Yeah, I mean, he's acting like a reality TV producer.
Right. At first, he implied it had gone overboard, and so they reined it in. And maybe that was why it ended. I mean, they wanted certain images and videos of terrible behavior, and they got that. Throughout the whole 6 days, he only had 6 hours of footage, and all of it was the worst moments. They didn't record the entire thing from start to finish. They only recorded very select moments, and it was all the worst of it, which is very interesting.
Right.
And the very first version of the story, apparently, was prisoners are badly affected by prison conditions, but that didn't sell. Because a lot of people turned around and asked, why did they do that to these young men? But then a month later, after the experiment, was the Attica Uprising, which was the bloodiest prison riot in American history. 9 hostages and 28 prisoners were killed, and another 100 people were injured. Authorities used a lot of force to bring an end to this uprising. It brought prison to the forefront of our culture, and people wanted to know why guards and authorities went in there with guns and tear gas and killed that many prisoners. And that was when Zimbardo's tune supposedly began to change a little bit and was when he was able to spin the story to focus on the guards and what they did.
Wow, so like the narrative is evolving to fit whatever people will listen to.
Yeah, supposedly. I mean, he just continually changed what he focused on in the story to make the story sell, like over the years.
Right. Okay. So this is science?
Mm-hmm. Well,
okay.
Right, exactly. In the archive, Letexier discovered several of the guards were shocked to discover that they were a subject in the experiment at all. He pretended like they were not being observed and treated them like they were actors because it was all about the prisoners' reactions, but that was a lie, as we know. He had an agenda to make something as shocking as possible and then go to the media. The media was a central character in the aftermath. One of the participants said, if nothing else, Zimbardo was a salesman. He really knew how to spin a story and make a sale. Right after the experiment, Zimbardo was invited to KRON TV, which was a local station in San Francisco where he met producer Larry Goldstein. He had the idea of doing a piece on the experiment, and Larry Goldstein had a certain vision for the piece. He wanted the drama to build even more than Zimbardo. Zimbardo told him that they had some ups and downs, but Goldstein told him he wanted the violence to really build. So he pushed Zimbardo to change his narrative even more to emphasize the intensity to make good TV. And that was how it was broadcast to the world for the first time in a real way. It showed video clips and audio, how sadistic the guards were, and how after only 36 hours, one of the prisoners had a complete mental breakdown and had to leave the experiment. And from there, Zimbardo's career skyrocketed. He made his career on this false narrative. Zimbardo many years later said, quote, "During this experiment, at any time, if you choose to stop being a participant, all you have to say is, I want to or I choose to quit this experiment. But Doug Corpy didn't say that. But during the study, Zimbardo was recorded saying, quote, the guys came in yesterday and said they wanted to leave. And I said, no, there's only two conditions under which you can leave, medical, health, or psychiatric. And I think they really believed it. And they just said, we can't leave.
Right. Dude, I mean, he should be sued into oblivion, truly. And he should lose his tenure.
Yeah. So the participants absolutely did not feel like they could leave whenever they wanted because he made them feel like they could not. They also had signed a document saying they could only leave under the authorization of Zimbardo. So Zimbardo made it seem like Dave had absolutely cracked, but honestly, it would have made complete sense that he faked it to get out of there because it sounded like a terrible time and he thought that that was the only way he could have. And Zimbardo continued spinning the story this way for years. He went on multiple TV shows, did countless interviews, TED Talks. The Stanford Prison Experiment was referenced in pop culture, in movies, in TV shows, in psychology textbooks. A rock band called itself the Stanford Prison Experiment. His fame was skyrocketing. And then the news came out about the Abu Ghraib prison, and Zimbardo implied that Abu Ghraib was the replication of his experiment, saying, quote, I had seen those images 35 years ago. My good guards did that in our mock prison the same way these Army reservists did it in Tier 1A Abu Ghraib. During the early stages of the Iraq War, members of the United States Army and the CIA committed a series of human rights violations and war crimes against the detainees in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. These abuses included physical abuse, sexual humiliation, physical and psychological torture and rape, as well as the killing of Manadel Ajamadi and the desecration of his body. So this is a horrendous thing that happened. And it was a stretch to say the absolute least that the Stanford Prison Experiment was the same as this. And that was bad enough. But then he acted as an expert witness for the defense. And he said these were just good apples put in a bad barrel. He was an expert witness for the defense of the Abu Ghraib prison trial.
So, like, they're good apples put in a bad barrel, and, like, what, that absolves them of a war crime?
Yes.
Like, that's literally insane.
Yes.
The whole justice system is predicated on you being able to make your own decisions and being responsible for them, right?
He said, this is exactly what my prison guards did, too. Hey, so no,
yeah,
it's not.
After you led them to do it.
Hey, first of all, no, it's not. They didn't kill anyone, and they didn't
rape anyone.
And they, like, oh my God, no, it's not. Like, so, hey, no, it's not. Absolutely insane. But he had built this career in such a big way that, like, he was able to, like, go on national television and say this with his chest in a way that he
seemed credible.
Seemed credible. Yeah.
Dude.
Insane. When I saw that come up in my research of this case, I was like, actually, what the hell is going on right now? Like, where have I gotten in this research? Like, how have I gotten this far off the rails? Like, what?
Yeah. This is hard to believe.
I know. Evil. Just evil. And then Zimbardo started talking about sexual abuse in Stanford prison experiment right after the Abu Ghraib scandal and claimed that the guards made the prisoners play sexual games, when in reality, that was highly exaggerated. They would do things like make the prisoners play leapfrog to humiliate them, which, like, sure, they were wearing a smock and no underwear. So is that problematic and bad? Yes. But were they doing the things that they were doing in Abu Ghraib? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So he was using the things that they did in the Stanford prison experiment to say, hey, to justify Abu Ghraib. So like that, you really cannot compare the two is my point.
Right.
But yeah, so like this is where Zimbardo went with this. And like when they said like, he's a good salesman, this is what they meant. It's crazy. And then—
I mean, he's just a scumbag.
Yeah. It's absolutely insane. And Abu Ghraib reunited interest in the Stanford prison experiment, which Zimbardo used as an opportunity to write his book, The Lucifer Effect.
Okay, so we're going to try and make money off of a war crime? Like,
of course.
How depraved. Like, you're the problem.
Of course he is.
Like, you should be studied.
Yes.
How do you get where you are?
Yes. So, yeah, so that's what they mean when they're like, he's a salesman, because he's going to use any possible opportunity he can to get his name out there and then capitalize off of it, even if it's a war crime.
Yeah, and he doesn't care what the circumstances
no.
are. Wow.
Yeah. So not only did he justify all of those heinous things and defend them, but then he used it as an opportunity to make himself more money.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why when in the beginning—
Is he still like a professor at Stanford?
No,
at this
he's
point?
Dead.
No. Like while this was happening.
Oh, no. No, he's like gone at that point and like making money on his many side hustles, like the Lucifer effect and such.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, like when I said in the beginning, like this case started out as one thing and turned into a complete other thing, I this is what I meant. I'm like, what? Like, how did we get here?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Insanity, depraved, disgusting, what the hell? So when Letexier got into looking into all of this, he didn't think he was going to have to debunk the Stanford prison experiment. But once he started finding all the discrepancies, he absolutely could not ignore it. He ended up reaching out to all the participants and writing a book himself because, again, there was so much there. He couldn't just ignore it. And he wrote the book Investigating the Stanford Prison Experiment, History of a Lie. And Stephen Riker, professor of psychology at University of St. Andrews, in 1999, the BBC came to him and told him they had the technology to observe behavior systematically and wanted to use that to revisit the Stanford Prison Experiment. So they took 15 men randomly, divided them into prisoners and guards, and did it again. And their findings were entirely different. Imagine that. The guards hated being in charge. They didn't want to be guards at all. They spoke about wanting to be prisoners. And they found that the leadership behind the Stanford prison experiment was critical. Zimbardo had been the leader telling the guards what to do, but without that, they didn't get the toxic behavior. Crazy, right? There was no evidence of guards conforming, quote-unquote, naturally to the role, but in response to manipulations that served to increase a sense of shared identity amongst the prisoners. Over time, they demonstrated increased resistance to the guards' regime. This culminated in a prison breakout on day 6 of the study that made the regime unworkable. After this, the participants created a self-governing commune. But this too collapsed due to internal tensions created by those who had organized the earlier breakout. After this, a group of former prisoners and guards conspired to install a new prison guard regime in which they would be the new guards. Now, however, they wanted to run the system along much harsher lines akin to those seen in the Stanford study. Signs that this would compromise the well-being of the participants led to early termination of the study. So it just kind of went all over the place, but...
I don't know. It is interesting that it ended up like some people took power, were about to take power, and then like they were talking about doing some heinous stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, it is interesting. I don't really know. I don't really know exactly how that study went entirely, but they did say that like without the toxic behavior of Zimbardo, it didn't go that way.
Right. So, wait, sorry, what year was this and who ran the study? The BBC?
It was in 1999 and it was led by psychologist Stephen Riker, but it was recorded by the BBC.
Oh, okay.
They had like the technology to observe it.
Interesting. I feel like I have whiplash in this story. Like there's so much. Are we done?
Almost.
Okay.
We're getting there. The participants from the Stanford Prison Experiment reunited more than 50 years later for the Stanford Prison Experiment Unlocking the Truth, a new three-part docuseries on National Geographic, where they recreated the experiment with actors and filmed it because the whole experiment had not been filmed originally. The men were able to give their input during filming and help them make it as accurate as possible. And thankfully, it was a mostly happy reunion and not a traumatic one. Some of them were more affected than others, though. Chuck Burton, one of the guards, called it one of three most pivotal experiences of his life and really shaped the way he went forward as an adult. Dave Eshelman was there and said, "I will say I had no contact with any of the participants after the experiment was over. I think Clay and I had a brief interview that was filmed after, but we all went our merry ways. We didn't have email back then, so we didn't keep in touch. It was a real trip to see everyone after 50 years. I may have been worried a little bit that they would have been mad at me. I was happy to find out they had gotten over it." Eshelman wanted to stay in arts and theater and ended up at Chapman University, music department. He loves music. He writes it and writes plays and directs them. He's a very nonviolent guy. He has multiple cats and said he became more like his father, who was Amish. And because of the experiment, he still gets hate mail from people, calling him a sadistic bastard, saying he should rot in hell, going to his business page and making false claims that he was terrible to work with and he tortured people, which sucks because it's been like over 50 years. Kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and he was pushed to do it.
Right. Clay, who was prisoner 416, said he didn't feel like Eshelman was being an actor and playing a part of a bad guard. It was just an excuse for his bad behavior and he still did all of it. So there's that.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm like, with that last comment, I'm like, all right, now we're not absolving him.
Right.
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 Because then, you know, now I'm contradicting what I just said like 10 minutes ago.
Right. Clay said it was a really extraordinary day getting to be there and be on the set. We had really almost too much to talk about amongst ourselves, much less do the things the director wanted to happen before the day was over. That is a memory I will cherish, the one day of shooting with all of us together and getting the chance to talk in all kinds of different ways, both in and out of camera. It was terrific. They were all just able to sit there and laugh with each other and talk it out. And yeah, they realized that they were not really angry at each other. They were just angry at Zimbardo. And they got to just talk it out, which was good, and film this like remake. So I think overall it was a positive experience for them, at least the remake. I mean, the Stanford Prison Experiment was not great for them, but it's been a long time. So I think they've all moved on, which is good. And Philip Zimbardo died in October of 2024. So he's gone, which I think is ultimately a good thing because he's done quite enough. But yeah, that's the story of the Stanford Prison Experiment. Holy moly.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe he was a witness defending the perpetrators of Abu Ghraib. I mean,
it's
just heinous.
Yeah.
And, you know, like this whole story, it was so long and I just felt like I got whiplash. And I was like, wait, what? Wait, what?
I know, you were sitting across from me when I was researching a good portion of it. And how many times did I like look up at you and just be like, what the hell am I researching right now? Like,
yeah. So I think like, didn't a bunch of new rules for ethics and studies come out of this?
I certainly didn't look into that, but I'd believe it.
I don't know. I thought that this is like the story to explain why we need ethics in a study.
That checks out.
Okay. So like the short answer is yes. It directly led to stricter ethical guidelines for human subject research. Yeah, I mean, I could go through all the things, but like pretty much like informed consent, like you need to be able to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy that he made them believe that they could not leave.
Yeah. The thing that's missing in this whole story for me is how he got to the point that he was before he did the experiment. He was a tenured professor. Like, that's really difficult to get and, you know, should be, you know, theoretically reserved for people who are brilliant and have worked really hard and want to be pursuing science in an unbiased way.
Yeah. Well,
and
I mean,
like, how did he get there? Like, it was through what? He was at Columbia.
Right.
He was at
NYU.
NYU. Now he's at Stanford. Like, these are all like our top universities, right? Or some of them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how he does such shoddy science.
He's definitely educated. I think the problem is that, he definitely had something else going on. But also, like, psychology at that time was a bit more loosey-goosey.
Was it newer?
I don't think it was, right? Newer, but there was definitely a lot less ethics involved. Like, there was a lot more problematic behavior with... Like, you could do a lot more to your participants that you certainly could not do today. Like, you could, like, shock people, you know?
Wow.
Like, there, well. And I wish I knew more off the dome right now that I really could not give you specifics. But, like, yeah, like, you could, like I said, like, you could literally shock people. Like, you could physically harm people for the name of psychology and science. Like, that, at that time. Because, I mean, this was 71, so, like... You know, not that much earlier, there was some really problematic stuff happening in psychology. So that would be an interesting thing to look into more specifically. But like, yeah, that, I mean, he was kind of at that time frame of like really problematic stuff happening for the name of psychology.
Yeah, there's that element of it. Like, there's like a really immoral part of the study, which mm-hmm. is the main part that I do want to say. But the other part that's crazy to me is it's just bad science yeah. on its face.
Like, totally.
He ran a terrible study.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that being said, he did just do bad science. Like, he wasn't.
Right.
Yeah. Like, that was just a bad study that he ran. So,
like, I don't know. Like, it's not shocking to me that somebody immoral would get into his position.
Yeah.
But it is kind of more shocking that they would do something so. This bad of science mm-hmm. as a tenured professor of psychology at Stanford.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It absolutely is insane.
I don't know.
But
dude.
I think he was just in it to become famous at the end. Like, I think he just wanted to gain, he wanted to have a name at the end. Because, I mean, he was filming it from the start. Like, literally from the moment the prisoners, quote unquote, were arrested, they were being filmed. So he obviously was trying to create a story out of it. He wanted it to be as shocking as possible. At least that's what it appears. It seems like he went directly like to the news as soon as it was over. So
yeah, well, like, hard to argue with his actions.
Right. Like, he continued to alter the story to fit whatever narrative was making him the most money over the many, many years of his career. Like, that's what he wanted. That's what he valued. It wasn't like he didn't value the ethics and the good science and the, you know, whatever. He valued making money. So, you know, he defended Abu Ghraib. Like, why are we, like, yeah. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
it's absolutely ridiculous. But anyway, yeah, that's the story. And maybe we'll look into some other crazy psychology studies that are in the 70s, 60s, 50s, because there are some crazy ones. I've also had MKUltra on my list forever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other can of worms, so.
Yeah. Well, that one leads into the, I don't know.
CIA?
The CIA, the Unabomber.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Like, yeah, that would be a huge story to talk about.
I know, which is why I haven't done it yet.
I know, it's just like.
Because every time I go to look into it, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to take me forever.
Yeah, it's also just so dark.
Yes, that too. But yeah. Someday I'll get into it. But anyway, I think that's enough yapping for this story. What's your good thing? Let's have a palate cleanser.
This one is particularly hard for me to transition from.
And that's why I've done it for you. Tell me your good thing.
Well, it was my birthday this week.
It sure was.
I have gotten older.
You have.
But it was cool. It was good. I got a day off from work,
mm-hmm.
so that was cool.
You've eaten crab about it?
I have eaten crab about it, which I love. I just love seafood.
Yep.
My birthday was a good thing.
That's good.
What's your good thing?
My good thing is that I got you a karaoke machine for your birthday.
Which is cool and could become a problem, but we find it fun to sing.
Also, we will be responsible with the power that we have.
Yes, maybe.
Yes. And, you know, we're adults. We have adult money, and you needed that in your life.
Probably.
You did.
If I need to use it to just yell at somebody, I will do it.
You needed it for good and for evil, dare I say.
Right. Okay.
And so that's my good thing.
And that's a good thing.
But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out all of the bonus episodes and all the perks over on Patreon, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy has happened to you and you'd like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to nottodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram @nottoday_podcast. We have merch at nottodaypodcast.dashery.com. We post TikToks at nottoday_podcast. And we have a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the T in the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.